Things look strange under headlights. When you get in the car and flip them on, the night jumps out at you, sudden, cold. And there's something out there, running towards you. Oh, it's just the long grass. The endless long beach grass, running and running in shadowy ripples toward you, away from the gusty cold wind. Still, you pull your feet in quickly and close the car door, filled with the feeling that something's about to grab you from underneath the car. Something cold and dark as the shadows out there, running through the grass. And once you close the door, the fear subsides. Well, now you're safe, surrounded by modernity. You can banish the night and wind and shadows with the touch of a few buttons. And you're just about to press those buttons when you squint ahead, down toward the beach, to that figure in the troubled grass out where your light ends. Running. Running like the shadows. Running towards you, faster than the gale. Is it? It's impossible, but panic squeezes your throat and you jab for that soft, glowing button that'll get you out of here. The one that says start. You jab for it, but you don't press it. Not because you don't know where it is or you've missed your aim, but because something from the darkness inside of the car takes hold of your wrist. Clenching, hard and cold and slimy. Something that feels like 400 years in boggy ground. Something like a buried legend. Thankfully, there's nothing like that here, in this cozy little book-lined nook where we unearth these legends. Thanks for joining us for the fourth and final part of our first story here on Buried Legends, the story we're calling Fool's Gold. If you haven't heard them yet, I'd recommend going back and listening to parts 1 through 3. You'll hear about a sailor on the Washington coast in 1911 who was found wandering a lonely beach with old Spanish doubloons in his fist and nothing left in his mind. And you'll learn the legend of the treasure that the sailor's coins must have come from. The haunted treasure that Sir Francis Drake buried somewhere on this coast. And then you'll hear about this. This little stack of ragged, yellowed old paper here, covered in scribbles and faded ink sketches. It's an old routier, a rough sailing log, recording part of Drake's circumnavigation. And it led the man who found it. It led him into a tunnel of trees and bushes and vines beside a chilly little creek, just above a wide gray beach in Washington State. It led him to a spot beside that creek where piles of gold from 400 years ago poured out of his shovel and into his backpack until the fabric of the pack strained under the weight. At that point, it seemed to him like these old yellow pages couldn't help him anymore. They led him right to the golden heart of a dream he'd chased his whole life. What more could they possibly have to share? He could guide himself back down the creek, across a few miles of empty beach, back to his boxy rental car and his sandy little motel room. But there is this line right here. Well, it begins right after the pages that have been torn out, the pages that led him to the treasure. Well, it all looks like squiggled hieroglyphics to me, but well, then I don't know the first thing about 16th century shorthand. But I'm told that this sentence here seems to read, "Here is that which cannot be." But that doesn't make much sense, does it? And our treasure hunter assumed that he wasn't deciphering that sentence correctly. He was about to learn, though, that it means just what it says. With his heart as full as his pack, he started back down the stream and crawled through the cold water out of the dense brush and into the waving beach grass. He crept his careful way through that and then sat for a long time at the edge of it, watching the beach to make certain that no one was out walking who might see him emerge. The clouds above were solid, driving. The breakers away down the beach were larger now. The evening light was already low. A stormy night was threatening. The gulls wheeled and screamed, and as soon as he was sure it was clear, he stood and was off. The wind whipped sand around his legs and piled it in strange patterns all across the beach. His feet sank deep, even in the hard, wet sand closer to the waves. The pack was very heavy, and he sweated in spite of the growing chill, breathing fast and loud. But with every breath he caught, he hummed a cheerful tune. He was so, so happy, and soon to be so, so rich. Night had almost completely fallen when he glanced behind him and noticed, for the first time, that he wasn't alone. Far, far behind him. In fact, right near the little creek where his return journey had started, he saw a figure. That's all he could see, just a figure, an outline, distorted by distance in the beach's odd optics to look much taller and thinner than anyone could be. Who was it? Who could be back there? There was nothing up that way. No beach access point for dozens of miles. Nowhere for the figure to be coming from. That must be one of those beach hikers, tramping and camping out down the whole coast. Or maybe it was just an all-day beach walker, returning to the same parking lot as he was. Either way, he tried to hurry. He didn't want them to catch up. He didn't feel like small talk. Didn't want the extra weight, however slight, of the lies he'd have to smile out for some unsuspecting stranger. Night seemed to arrive between one step and the next. One minute the cloudy sky glowed a dim purple all over, and the shadow figure behind him was still visible way back there, not gaining or falling back, just keeping pace. The next minute came darkness, so complete that he couldn't see the sand in front of him. Those were the hardest miles. He had to leave the packed wet sand and venture into the dry, soft stuff up toward the grass, lest his flashlight miss that twisted old stump that marked the mouth of the trail back to the parking lot. His tired feet sank into the soft hillocks of sand. Now and then he staggered, but he kept the pace up, sweating and panting and driving himself as fast as he could away from that feeling, that silly feeling that the unseen other behind him was gaining. The last stretch seemed to take far too long. He could feel bleeding blisters in his shoes and on his shoulders where the pack straps bit, and on his thumbs where he'd shove them under the straps for some relief. But finally, there it was, an upturned monster of ancient driftwood, bleached sickly white by the decades, its huge broken roots reaching up toward the dark sky, casting black shadows behind it that moved crazily in his bobbing flashlight. Exhausted as he started to jog with joy. And then he was flying. Oh, he was flying! Once he'd opened the hatchback of his rental car and slung the sweat-heavy pack in there, if you've ever finished a long backpacking trip and dropped your heavy pack, you know the feeling. He was floating, flying. It felt hard to keep his feet on the ground. He walked in circles, slapping his aching shoulders gingerly, taking care to avoid the blistered places. He shone his light around and was glad to see that there were no other cars there at all. The parking lot was his alone, though it didn't feel like it. He had an acute sense that someone else was out there in the night. Someone was watching him. Of course, without a car, that was impossible. This spot was miles from nowhere. He was alone. He must be. And then he wondered about that figure he'd seen behind him on the beach. Where could they be heading, if not to some car parked here? Well, that settled it. It must be a hiker. No doubt they'd stopped and set up camp back up the beach somewhere. Well, they must have. He felt a little sorry for them. It was a cold night out there, windy and black. By the sound of the breakers, it was going to get much worse before it got better. Well, anyway, they'd made their sandy bed, now they'd have to sleep in it. Whoever they were. So, well, there was no reason to stay around here, windmilling his arms and feeling nervous. Might as well get on the road, back to the motel, back under the lights, where he could spread his pack load out and really see what incredible things he'd got. He hopped in the car and he slammed the door behind him. He turned the key and switched the heater on, though the air blew cold at first. Then he flipped on the headlights and snapped his head so quickly toward the driver's side window that a sharp pain flashed in his neck. Because right there, out the driver's side window, he'd seen. He knew for a fact that someone had been right there, face pressed against the glass, staring at him. Right there. So close that he fumbled to press the door locks. He couldn't see anything out there now. When the lights sprang on, whoever it was, it dropped. He'd seen the face, seen it drop out of the corner of his eye. But it dropped quickly. Too quickly. Down below the window. Out of sight. But still, right out there. Leave. He had to leave this place. Up ahead, in the unforgiving glare of the headlights, the wind in the beach grass gave the illusion that it was running toward him. Waves and waves and waves of grass, ghosts, shadow figures running toward him, and one particular shadow seemed to separate from the others. Seemed to wade toward him through the waves of grass, tall, lean, taller, faster than any person could be. Running now, flying toward him, faster and faster. In panic, he reached for the shifter to throw it in reverse and took hold, not of the shifter, but of cold, wet bone. Long, close bones like the back of a too large hand, but uncovered by flesh. Smooth and wet and cold. So cold. They were articulated, jointed, held together with thready, slick, slimy tendons, and they clutched the shifter in an icy, unmovable grip. Then, faster than anyone, faster than anything, faster than he could think, and far faster than he could move. The bones weren't on the shifter anymore. They'd flown up onto his face. The bones of two hands. More. A crowd of bones gripping and covering his face, too tight to shake off. Cold and wet and slimy. Some sliding, some pinching, some holding. And all tightening. All beginning to crush his face between those sliding, greasy bones, smelling so strong of the same musty earth that he dug back there up the beach, smelling so strong he could taste it. He could taste 400 years in the cold, wet ground. He ripped his head away so fast and strong that he cracked the glass of the driver's side door with the side of his skull, and the tender flesh there began to bleed and bleed. But the bones stayed right with him, sliding and gripping and squeezing his face, smothering his will to scream even as he did so, over and over and over again. He reached beside and behind himself, and he slammed his fingers and elbows and fists and arms onto the door lock controls, and he tore and tore and tore at the latch until the door behind him finally gave way. and he fell out of the door onto the sandy ground. And even as he fell, in the light that switched on when the door opened, he saw the lighted interior of the car. And he saw inside it, saw that there was nothing there at all. Nothing that he could see, except perhaps the shadow. The shadow of something tall and bone lean. Something coming toward him. Oh, I would have run. Wouldn't you? I know, I would have run off blindly. I don't think I could have helped myself. And he almost did. He wanted to, more than anything. But he knows he would have been lost if he had. Running into the blackness all night, into the trees and feel grasping branches clawing at his face like those bones. Or down the beach, through all that waving, tripping grass. Maybe into the salt surf and oblivion. At best, found some mornings later, like the sailor in the old story, wandering, mumbling, forever unmoored, too wrecked to return to the port of reason. Oh, but somehow he didn't run. Doom lay that way. Deep down, he sensed it. But if he didn't run, you ask, what did he do? He put it back. Can you imagine? Bleeding shoulders back under the heavy strap, still wet with sweat. Step after blistered step, deep in miles of soft sand. Headlamp getting dimmer, wind getting stronger, rain lashing at the blood that streamed from his glass-bitten head. Through miles and miles of night, and every step haunted by the hollow rattle of bones just behind him, like the sound of distant driftwood being driven against the shore by a terrible storm. Every gust of sea wind mixed with the slightest scent of a sandy grave. And then, into the black mouth of the forest where the creek dribbled out, crawling on hands and knees through wet, slimy invisibles toward the spot, toward the very source of all his horror. But he made it. He made it back there, with the thing hovering over him so close that he dare not look around at it. He just kept his eyes on the ground, working feverishly, digging with his bare hands. And he put it back. All of it. Everything. Every single coin. Then he staggered and crawled back down that creek. And he ran along the sand through the stinging rain of a wild storm, just above breakers like falling mountains that threatened to devour the whole beach. He never looked back. He never went back. He never wants to go back. And he'll never, 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 never tell you where it is. Unless, he says, he truly hated you. And he'd smile, and he'd wink, and he'd slide close, and he'd whisper in your ear. And he'd tell you just exactly where a person could find their weight in ancient stolen gold, among other things. Oh. Well, here comes the rain against our window. Startled me a bit. Well, it's a good evening to be in here, in our archive, our cozy little book-lined room under the eaves of this warm old house. Well, better here than out on a beach somewhere, caught between the rain and the waves. There'll be a storm tonight, sure. Maybe you'd better head home before things get too nasty. Thanks for coming over. I hope you swing by next time we happen to unearth some buried legend. But now that we've told this story, I'm sending these pages, this old Rutger, back to the museum that the fellow says he took it from. Oh, don't worry about it tempting anyone else. As soon as he got away from that terrible beach, he tore out the crucial pages, burned them, and threw the ashes to the gusting wind. A sad fate for a piece of such a unique artifact, but the past can be a strange, frightening place. Some things are best left there. And speaking of unique artifacts, many thanks to our engineer, Nick Patrie, a true gentleman, relic of a gentler, quieter age. I don't know what it is about him that reminds me of a wise and affable country doctor from the 1800s. But when I tell him that, he just laughs softly and shakes his head, claps me on the shoulder, and reminds me that I can take the leeches off in 2 days. Meanwhile, our senior producer, Chelsea Davis, is from the future, which explains why her fashion sense is always 6 months ahead of the latest trends. Although, it is a bit unnerving that she keeps looking at me with such sad, sorry eyes. What is it, Chels? What's going to happen to me? For the time being, I remain your faithful writer and host, Weston Davis. Thanks for joining us here on Buried Legends for all 4 episodes of this story that we've been calling Fool's Gold. We'll be back soon with another legend for you. Subscribe if you haven't already, and spread the word. If you like these tales in this format, leave a good review. If you don't like it, come on, don't leave a rating like that. Just drop us an email at buriedlegendspodcast@gmail.com. We'll hear you. And if you have any treasure maps leading to ideas for legends you'd like us to dig up, well, that's a great place to send them. You never know what our shovels may uncover. As always, these buried legends of ours are just legends. Some people claim to have had similar experiences, but it's up to you which pages belong in a museum and which deserve to be scattered to the wind. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.